COVID cases are on the rise again in Florida. New details on that proposed gas tax for Duval County and what it would pay for. And the controversy surrounding local school name changes continues. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Email us and tweet us. We are having a little issue with our phone lines, so email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or tweet me at Melissa Injax as we discuss the news. Then later, author and fifth-generation Florida man Tyler Gillespie on his new book, The Thing About Florida. That's later, but first it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we're pleased to welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Writer-journalist Claire Goforth with us this morning. Hi, Claire. Oh, we'll have Claire in a moment. Blogger and regular contributor Fred Matthews. Hey, Fred. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to hear your voice. And Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
So good to have you all. Lots to talk about this week, and we'll go to everyone's audience feedback in a moment. But let's begin with the top story, which has been the top story for a long time now, COVID-19. We are sorry to tell you that cases are once again on the rise around the state. Even as vaccine eligibility expanded this week to encompass all adults, everyone 18 and older now eligible to get the vaccine, and 16-year-olds can get the Pfizer vaccine. Here are the numbers. Thursday, the state reported 7,939 new COVID cases. That is the largest single-day increase in Florida since February. Here's some more bad news. Nearly half of new coronavirus infections nationwide are now concentrated in just 5 states. And you guessed it, Florida is one of them. So the virus, the pandemic, still very active here. And to add even more wrinkles to this, the highly contagious B.1.1.7 variant of COVID is now the dominant strain of the virus in this state. In fact, Florida has more cases of this variant than almost any other state. And so as we begin this discussion, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweet us at Melissa Injax, or you can also comment on Facebook. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. New York, Michigan, Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey together make up nearly 50% of the nation's new COVID-19 infections. And so we just can't stress this enough to people listening. The pandemic isn't over. The mask mandate may be over. More people are getting vaccinated, but we are not done with this yet. We've got to get this message out, particularly since that highly contagious and more deadly strain of the virus is the dominant type of virus now in our area and across the state.
Well, I've got 3 events to think of that could be part of the increase. We had Bike Week in Daytona Beach a few weeks ago. We've had spring break that went on still through this week for many folks in colleges. And then Miami Beach got so crazy that they had a curfew because of all the crowds in the streets, mostly on masks. I do learn that that curfew has been lifted. So that's a few thousand people right there exposed without masks. And the possibility that there was a mass contagion event could have occurred at any of them. Plus, it is springtime. People are out. I don't see anyone wearing masks anymore except inside stores. Occasionally, and walking into restaurants where obviously they take them off. So I'm thinking people think, gee, the vaccine's out there. I've got my shots, which I have. So it's okay.
Yeah. Fred Matthews, I think that a lot of people have that attitude, even though only about 20% of Americans have gotten both shots so far when you look at everybody combined. And we've got this Ultimate Fighting Championship event coming up in Jacksonville. It's going to be packed to the rafters. So when you go around town, is that what you're noticing as well? People sort of acting as though it's all over with, even though it's not?
Well, I don't think they're so much acting as it's all over with as it is that they're done with having to be caged. And with the availability of getting the vaccine for virtually every adult, those who really want to get it or want to get it, are going to get it, and that is encouraging the population as a whole, especially in our area, that it's okay. Let's get on out there. And with the number of people who've had COVID, that's the other part of it. With the folks who've had the illness and have recovered from it, they're spreading the word that, hey, it's okay. You'll be all right. You'll recover from it. It's like getting the flu. But what they don't consider, of course, is what we now know to be the after effects of getting the COVID-19 virus. But yes, it's springtime and folks are out at Walmart. There's a line for cashing your stimulus check. And there's a line for getting your returns. And that line for the stimulus check is long and maskless.
Yes, yes, exactly. Tim Gibbons, our business editor, as we noted, the mayor has ended the mask mandate now that we're in April. However, when you go into grocery stores and other businesses, you do still see people honoring it. So from the perspective of CEOs and business leaders that are still trying to keep their workforce safe, what are you hearing from that group?
Well, there's the people who liked the mandate because it stopped the arguments from customers. I mean, at this point, as a business owner, it's kind of a losing fight to try to tell people coming into your retail establishment or coming into your restaurant that they have to wear a mask because you don't have the force of law behind it anymore. So, you know, you talk to some business owners who basically are giving up on that. They can still make their employees wear them, but it's just a much harder fight to get customers to do that. Yeah, there is the science of even if you've been vaccinated, wearing a mask, because there are people who have compromised immune systems and can't get vaccinated or who might not just have been able to yet. And as you said earlier, this isn't over, but a vast majority of people are just kind of shrugging and going, yeah, let's pretend it is.
Yeah. And Claire Goforth, this variant is the thing that public health experts seem to be most concerned about. We have more cases of this more contagious, more deadly COVID variant than almost any other state. We spoke the other day with an infectious disease specialist at UF Health Jacksonville, and he said it's really a race between the spread of the variant and the pace at which they can get more people vaccinated, particularly younger adults. The virus is spreading the most now with people under 50. Most seniors in Florida have gotten the vaccine. So the population that is really the one to watch now is that younger population, right?
It certainly is. And I mean, people like to think that if you're young and you have a lower chance of dying from the disease, that it's fine, you can just get it. But the fact is that Reuters reported this week that a third of COVID survivors suffer neurological or mental disorders. And that doesn't matter what age cohort you're in. And yet we see in Jacksonville, the mask mandate has been lifted and we are vaccinating far under capacity. And, you know, you would think that we're so close to what you may call the finish line or, approaching it. And it's almost as if we fumbled on the 10-yard line. Mm-hmm. We have plenty of spots to get vaccinated, and a lot of people are putting it off for a variety of reasons. But one of those reasons is misinformation. People are taking it from their loved ones and from things that they read online or watch on YouTube. And they have these gross misconceptions about what will happen if you take the vaccine. I've taken the vaccine. It was fine. And it's a great relief. But at the same time, you know, we need the entire population to buy into this because it is a deadly disease. It is a deadly disease that has long-term complications that we still don't understand completely. And if you miss your chance to get the vaccine and catch the virus, it's not like you're just going to be fine. You need to have a real honest conversation with the public about what could be the long-term impacts of catching this virus.
Right. Dan Scanlon, you know, if you buy a ticket to the Ultimate Fighting Championship event in Jacksonville, with your ticket, you accept a disclosure that's part of the purchase, that you run the risk of catching COVID-19 or even dying from it, and that you waive any liability related to attending the event. Pretty remarkable, still, that is happening.
Yeah, and that has been the case in some events, including some of the Republican events, prior to the election, where that was part of what you signed off on when you got the ticket. And again, I just got a blood test done. I had just gotten my second Moderna shot. The nurse said, "You are still wearing your mask, right?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Good. That is a basic medical fact. Wear it. If you get it, you don't transfer it. If you have the shot and still carry it, you don't get it." And then this week I was at Memorial Hospital where hundreds of nurses, doctors, and staff put down flags to commemorate 13 months of fighting COVID-19. They were the first hospital apparently in Northeast Florida to have a COVID patient 13 months ago.
Right. That they had that Flags of Hope event last week. Mm-hmm. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday roundtable. We are attempting to reboot our phone system, but you can reach us right now at First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweet the show at Melissa and Jax. Our Facebook page is open. Here's an email from a listener. "My friend's son is suffering horribly from COVID weeks after no longer having the virus. Kids can get COVID and can suffer from it. People still need to wear masks to protect the vulnerable, adults and kids." And so, Fred Matthews, let me throw a number out at you. Duval County now has administered nearly $400,000 of vaccine as of April 6th. That's up 12% from the previous week's tally of about 348,000. 16% of Duval County residents are fully vaccinated. So we are still at an under 20% vaccination rate in Duval County. On this show, almost every day, we let people know where all the vaccination sites are. You can go to the Gateway FEMA site. You can go to the Regency Mall. You can go to your retail pharmacy. You can go, there are a number of places, satellite sites. The Edward Waters College site was set up specifically to help people who don't have easy access to the vaccine. There is no shortage of places for people to get vaccinated. We just need to keep bringing this up and encouraging people to go and get their shot.
Well, the movement at the Gateway site in particular has been better now that the age has been lowered for folks to get in there and the obstacles are lowered. I think, I'm not sure about the, I think the Regency site has the same thing. It's, they're seeing an increase in folks getting there. And there's no question that the word is out. You have folks literally walking neighborhoods with their shirts and notebooks trying to get folks to come out mm-hmm. and get themselves vaccinated. The issue, the biggest impairment we have right now is that, believe it or not, we still have a group of people who believe that if they take the shot, they're going to get sick or sicker. And what we try to tell folks all the time is that what one recent pastor said, it's better to get a cough than get a coffin. And the more we can relay that to people, I think we'll see that increase. They are seeing an increase of folks coming out to it, but there's still a hesitance about it to get it done. But I think that that we'll reach at least 30-40% hopefully by the end of May in Jacksonville, and everybody be well on the way to getting what will be our time out for us to herd immunity by July, because everybody will want to make sure they're ready to go to Jaguars game come late August.
Yeah, that's right. Tim Gibbons, how about this? The five counties with the highest percentage of fully vaccinated people are Charlotte County, Indian River County, Sarasota County, Sumter County, that's where the Villages is, and St. John's County. St. John's County is the champ in terms of getting their population all vaxxed up. Duval County has a long way to go. And yes, the FEMA site is seeing more traffic, but it's interesting to note that when they look at vaccination rates, people seem, in many cases, to prefer to go to their Walmart, their CVS, or their Walgreens, to a business, to get the vaccine. What do you think about that?
If you want to have a time and date where you're definitely going to show up, that the going to the private business has been easier for some people. It is interesting that St. John's County has such a high percentage. I know in doing some reporting at the FEMA sites, you had people coming up to Duval County from St. John's County, several weeks ago, because they could go to the FEMA site and get shots there. But it is that idea that we just need to have widespread acceptance of this, or else the virus will keep on mutating and you know, this won't end.
Yeah. I hate to beat this over and over again, Claire, but let's make that point one more time, and then we'll move on to some other news and notes of the week. Let me just disclose, I've been fully vaccinated with two doses of the Moderna under a waste protocol opportunity that I found out about. And so, you know, really, people, please go get whatever vaccination is available. It's not that bad. I had a sore arm, Claire, both times. I had a little headache both times, and that was about it.
Yeah, I have received one dose of the Pfizer vaccine. It was a great relief. I went through CVS because, like many people, I think I preferred to know that I was going to get the vaccine at a specific time rather than show up and potentially wait in line, although we seem to know that that's probably not the case given how under capacity we're vaccinating people. And it was a sore arm the next day. I slept a lot that night, and that was it. You know, it's a very easy process. It's very fast. But when I was in line, there was a woman behind me, and I don't know how old she was, but I would guess that she's well into her late 60s or 70s. And she's been eligible for the vaccine for weeks and weeks and weeks. And she was afraid of getting it. And so that she was there for her first shot. Her friend brought her, I think her friend kind of coerced her into it. Mm-hmm. And she was specifically concerned because she said they had rushed the vaccine. And now, while we do know that it was the fastest vaccine rollout in history, the truth is that they've been working on these mRNA vaccines for many years. This is not some new type of technology that they've invented. It's something that they have long been looking into. And this, you know, COVID-19 terrible tragedy gave them the opportunity to use it to life-saving effect. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not dangerous. What is it, 145 million Americans or something have taken it. Yeah. And the risk of complications, allergic reactions, are extremely small. And that's why they monitor you for 15 minutes. It's a very safe vaccine. And with only 15% of our population in Jacksonville vaccinated, I find it really mind-boggling that the governor would sue to reopen cruise lines at this time. But, you know, mm-hmm. we need people out there to get the shot. It's very important. You could be saving your life. You could be saving someone else's life.
Right. It is now incontrovertible that the more vaccinations go into more arms, the more hospitalizations go down in higher vaccinated populations, the fewer deaths we're seeing. This vaccine protects against hospitalization, a serious case of COVID requiring hospitalization and death. And so please go get the vaccine, everyone. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. We are talking about the biggest stories of the week with Claire Goforth, Tim Gibbons, Fred Matthews, Dan Scanlon, and myself. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweet at Melissa N. Jax and weigh in on Facebook. We're going to move on and talk about another big story from the week. The JTA board, that's the Jacksonville Transportation Authority, they unanimously approved this week a list of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of transportation projects. The most visible and the most controversial of these projects is one that would extend the downtown Skyway system into neighborhoods surrounding downtown. It would give the Skyway a bigger footprint. Now, these projects would be paid for, many of them, by doubling the local gas tax from 6 to 12 cents a gallon. The mayor has sold this as a jobs plan, too. A new UNF study says the Jobs for Jax plan would generate more than 7,000 local jobs tied to these projects. We do need to note JTA did commission that study. Dan Scanlon, Florida Times Union, let's talk about this. These transportation projects are needed. The gas tax is something that the city council is likely to pass. At the same time, it's pretty controversial among many voters out there to be asked to tax themselves to pay for anything having to do with the Skyway. The Skyway has long been regarded as a boondoggle. And so what about the politics of this? Spending more money to somehow improve the Skyway, make it more user-friendly, actually get more people riding it. Let's talk about what this money would do with the Skyway.
Well, the Skyway is 2.5 miles long, and I can still remember how they wanted to extend it down to the stadium, and that died on the vine, and that would have actually made it useful in many cases. The only time, as you noted this week yourself, the only time that we've ridden it is maybe to go to a downtown event where you couldn't park near it. That's 2.5 miles now, but the plan is to rebuild it into an autonomous vehicle pathway, 10 miles plus, that would drop down and put these autonomous vehicles on Bay Street, other downtown vehicle areas, down to the La Villa JTA headquarters, and possibly even into the San Marco area. And we've had this ultimate urban circulator in testing modes for years. The test track was right down the street from WJCT, so this is not new. Mm-hmm. As a project, the 10.2-mile system is not new either. But at the time they announced it, it was $379 million. And here now there is funding. And maybe this is what JTA has been asking or hoping for all along, was a gas tax or some kind of infrastructure fee that they could tap in to build this thing. And again, the biggest thing is we're going to have autonomous vehicles running down Bay Street with sensors and stuff so that they don't run into people, that they react to stoplights, et cetera. But I'm sure people aren't going to be happy to see a driverless mini vehicle slowly chugging along the center of Bay Street. It just might be interesting, but it is the future if we have places to go to.
Yeah, exactly. Fred, the thought of these driverless cars buzzing around downtown is kind of cool and interesting to think about. And you do hope it works and it can actually help people who need to get where they're going. But of course, there's just an enormous amount of cynicism about anything having to do with the Skyway. And let's also point out it will cost a lot of money to improve it. For people who say that it's no good and we should just get rid of it, it would cost tens of millions of dollars to tear it down. So, you know, there's really no easy solution to this.
There is none. And the best that the JTA can do is what they've done, and that's just to steamroll ahead with a plan for the future to make this system relevant. Because yes, as Dan just mentioned, the only reason for taking the Skyway was because there was a parking issue around City Hall or going to the federal courthouse, it's just ridiculous trying to get a parking space. So you park over there by the FCCJ, hop on the Skyway and get off and go to your meeting or go attend an event at James Weldon Johnson Park, and you're straight. But the autonomous vehicle issue for getting to the stadium is encouraging, but what will be also equally encouraging will be, of course, its reach to San Marco, and possibly I'd like to even see it go over to the Riverside area for them, a La Villa area. But will we have something in central Jacksonville, in downtown Jacksonville, for them to come to? That's the other part of it. And let me just add this one little tidbit here, Melissa. Isn't it interesting that we have a Republican administration proposing a tax increase at the same time that the national administration is proposing a tax increase for infrastructure?
Yeah, how about that? Yeah, but let's talk about that. Tim, Claire, this is the mayor saying we've got to raise a tax. It's not a property tax. It's a gas tax. People will notice it at the pump. It's being sold, Tim, let's start with you, as a jobs plan. As a way to create jobs.
And that obviously the jobs piece of it is always the audience-friendly bit because everybody likes jobs. I want to go back to a key point that Fred made there, though, on will we have something downtown to make the Skyway make sense? And I think that JTA is looking at this as part of a totality. We talk about the shipyards and we talk about stuff going on at the former site of the landing. We talk about James Weldon Johnson Park. We talk about the other part, the Lift Every Voice and Sing Park in La Villa. If we're going to have things grow up in the downtown area and the historic neighborhoods surrounding it, there's not enough space for people to park to get to all those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Jack's River Jam last night had, you know, thousands of people come downtown during a pandemic. If we're going to have more of that thing, we have to have people move around. And that's the idea behind this.
Sure.
But there is a chicken and egg issue of if you don't have the things, so what that you have these vehicles driving around, nobody's using them.
Exactly. Here's an email, Claire, from Tyrona. She emails the show. Did the mayor and his administration research any other possible revenue sources before deciding to pursue a 6% increase in the gas tax. There are several alternatives, such as an impact fee that can create a revenue stream. Furthermore, the mayor has lost our trust with the JEA debacle. Why should we trust his administration? And the cost of gasoline in Jacksonville varies depending on what side of town you're on. Prices are higher in the inner city and sections of the north side. The mayor is asking those who can't afford to pay more for gas to fund infrastructure projects. And the north side is the side of town that hasn't received the infrastructure projects it was promised over 50 years ago. Why should we trust this mayor and his administration to use the money as promised? Claire.
That's a very good point. And I think one of the things she's alluding to is that taxes like this are called regressive. They have what they deem a, you know, an equal impact on everybody. But in reality, it's a disproportionate impact on the poor, the people who can least afford a slight increase in the bill at the pump. And they do this because there really isn't public support for a millage rate increase or for other forms of revenue. And I believe that part of that is because of the high net worth individuals, the syndicate of Jacksonville. They don't want to pay more for their property taxes, quite frankly. And so this gas tax is an easy sort of easy sell to the public and to the donor class. And at the same time, you know, I mean, it does make it harder for people who are making minimum wage to make ends meet. We do need these projects, right? Like, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
But do we need to do it at the expense of our neediest citizens? I think that, I mean, in reality, it's probably the only way we're going to get that money, because there's no way they're going to pass a millage rate increase. I mean, every single member of city council and the mayor is well aware of the kind of political blowback they'll get on a move like that. And we are already seeing some of the more conservative members of council, even some people who are seen as allies to the mayor, who are kind of pushing back on it, particularly because of the Skyway. The Skyway, you know, I've used it. I used to, when I worked downtown, I used to ride it regularly. I would take it across the river to go to lunch. But now, as we're a year into a pandemic that's closed so many restaurants and businesses in the downtown footprint, I think it's an even harder sell for the public, because people are saying to themselves, I don't go downtown anymore. And how many of the office class that people used to work downtown now are working from home? So we've lost this huge chunk of business for all of those places downtown. And will they come back? I mean, I think we're all wondering, what is the workforce going to look like a year from now, 5 years from now, that we've learned that people can work from home
exactly
quite effectively, you know?
Yes, that's such an important point. The long-term effects of the pandemic will be fascinating to watch when it comes to transit and how people move around. You know, Dan Scanlon, I know you grew up in a northern city with a mass transit system. Down here, you probably don't use the bus as often, because you're like a lot of other people. There's not a bus stop near you. We did just pass a half-cent sales tax for schools, so people might be weary with all of this. Now, all of that said, there are dozens of road, drainage, and transit projects that they want to do with this money, totaling nearly $1 billion. Drainage alone is a huge issue. We do have old, outmoded, barely working infrastructure in many parts of town. Many neighborhoods don't have proper drainage or decent roads or other kinds of infrastructure. Claire is right in that this stuff is needed.
Well, the bottom line is, anytime we have a nor'easter or any bad weather, as a Times Union reporter, I'm usually hanging out around certain parts of the city that are underwater. And once your road's underwater, it starts deteriorating. So it's pothole city, even if we don't have any freezes to help like they did back in New York. So definitely our roads are in trouble. Our sewer system's in trouble. Our water system, we have septic tanks and septic fields in places that could be leaking into waterways. It is a concern. And if you've ever had to wade through water to do a story on a flooded street, you can understand the reasons why. But yeah, I've only taken the Skyway, like I said, to downtown events. I've only taken a JTA bus to go shuttle to a Jaguars game. I've never been able to walk to a bus stop like I did back in New York, where everywhere I went, I had a bus stop or a subway.
Yeah, big difference here with our built environment. And when we talk about coming downtown, someone mentioned people are maybe less likely to do that lately. Here's a tweet from a listener. The Jacksonville Symphony is in full swing. Go downtown and listen. It's amazing, he says. Thanks for that. It's our Friday roundtable with Dan Scanlon, Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, Tim Gibbons, and myself. We're having an issue with our phone lines today, so email us as we talk about school renamings now, or it's firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or tweet me at Melissa Injax. This was another big story from the week, the latest on the effort to change local school names with ties to the Confederacy or the colonial era of the United States. On Monday night, a school advisory committee proposed four alternative names for Lee High School. Now, here they are: Avondale High School, Legacy High School, Riverside High School, or School Number 33. That one doesn't sound too exciting. But there were demonstrators, Fred, outside the school campus before the meetings, holding up signs saying change the names. Activists have been pressuring Duval County Public Schools for a long time now to change these school names. Nine schools are under consideration for name changes, but of course, Lee High School has sort of become the focal point of this whole community debate. And so I think it's a foregone conclusion they're going to pick one of those four names, Fred. But that's what we could soon be looking at, maybe Avondale or Riverside High School.
Yes, this is one of those inevitabilities for Lee because it has been such a focus. It is such, and one of the names, of course, being considered a legacy, I think, in there. It's such a focal point for the movement that has been taking place all around this country over the last few years in particular. So it will be interesting when this finally comes up, when the superintendent makes her recommendation to the school board for these changes, who will be saying what from the school board side when this comes down to it. You know, I do understand the oppositions. Certainly the alumni who have been supporting Lee financially for a number of years, their anger even at having to change the name. But I think, you know, again, as we've talked about before, this is about history. It is also about the fact that, you know, we've got 75-80% of the student body is African American. Yeah. And the idea that they would be attending a school for a guy who held their ancestors as slaves and fought against the United States of America to maintain states' rights, as you would call it, is just something that cannot be contained now. So it's rather interesting. Also, I'd like to, it'll be interesting to see how the folks over at Rebalt High and Rebalt Middle come down on their name. This is not tied directly to the Confederacy as the others. It's tied to a indigenous American issue.
Right.
They're going through the same process. They've met, I think they are about through with their process also. It'll be interesting to see how they come down for the changing of their name, because it's not the same thing as all the others.
Yeah. And it has muddied the water a little bit on this whole discussion, Claire. I think most people of good faith can agree that the names tied to the Confederacy simply must go. There are, though, a vocal contingent of people in Jacksonville who have argued that Jean Ribault never harmed indigenous people when he first colonized this area. He was early French Huguenot explorer, that he was not a negative figure in history. And they have argued for keeping the Rebalt name. On this program, we even spoke with a gentleman who lives in Lyon, France, who is a direct descendant of Ribault. And he and other descendants of Ribault have made their case here in Jacksonville media, including on this show, arguing that his name is not one to be ashamed of. And so, yes, that kind of speaks to the complex history we have here in Northeast Florida with some of these place names. But what are your thoughts about the Rebalt name?
Well, it's one thing to name a school after a Confederate general who fought to keep African Americans enslaved, and it's another to change the name of a school that is named for an explorer who himself was slaughtered in America. You know, you're the French fan of First Coast Connect, which I just delight in thinking of.
Yes.
He makes a very good point that there's nothing in history I know of that Rebol did anything atrocious. He's no Christopher Columbus, that's for sure. So, I mean, when we think about this, are we saying to ourselves that everything about colonization was inherently wrong and we shouldn't have done it? I mean, maybe we could make that argument, but now we're 500 years out and we all live here and I'm proud to be an American. So do we just want to eradicate all of that history, everyone who had anything to do with colonization because of the result of it and how the Native Americans were treated? That's going so far. I mean, it's, you know, the Civil War was an atrocity and the cause behind it was an atrocity. So that's one thing. And why, you know, why would we want to keep remembering that and keep heralding these people? Mm. But I mean, everybody that ever touched American shores during the period of colonization who's from Europe, I don't know. That just seems like it's much further of an argument.
Colleen writes on our Facebook page, I don't think it's time to change the names because so many schools need the money to fix up the buildings and to improve education. There is a fund, Colleen, set up to pay through private donations for all of the costs of changing the signage and stuff on these school names. And Tim Gibbons, we've talked a bit on this show about the business class of Jacksonville. Certainly, as a business editor, you talk to these folks, and they want to put this behind us. They want Jacksonville to be seen as a forward-looking city, not a backward-looking city, because it's good for business.
It's been interesting when you look at some of the cultural or social flashpoints. You go back to the expansion of the Human Rights Ordinance, where you had groups like the Civic Council and the Jacks Chamber who came out pushing for these changes because it's not a good look when you're trying to attract investment, when you're trying to bring businesses in from other places to here. You want to be seen as a progressive, not necessarily in the political sense, but progressive as in a looking toward the future and enshrining the Civil War as a necessary cultural part of the city, and in the past ignoring things like James Weldon Johnson's contributions, it does not give the type of look. So I think there is somewhat of a sea change of people who want the city to grow, who want it to continue to attract investment. Where they basically want these fights to not be occupying the headlines.
You know, and let's also point out, Dan Scanlon, that the pressure to change the names, we've already seen Confederate monuments in this city come down. We saw the renaming of Heming Park to James Weldon Johnson Park, among other changes. Black Lives Matter protests last summer that were large and loud in this city and many others, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, contributed to this public pressure. The trial of the police officer accused of murdering Floyd is happening now up in Minnesota. And in the context of all this stuff, at the same time, the Florida legislature is looking to pass an anti-riot bill that critics say is a response to those Black Lives Matter protests. They claim it would muzzle the First Amendment of protesters and those who are engaging in peaceful protests because they could potentially charge with felonies if anyone at a protest becomes violent. So I wanted to bring up all of these different elements to the story because they're a big part of it.
Well, Ben Frazier, one of our community activists, has certainly been involved in both of those. He actually was part of a small protest this week in front of Lee High School, wanting that name changed. He also was instrumental in some of the protests we had over the summer for Black Lives Matters groups and others. Yet did I not see a tweet this week that somebody brought a Confederate flag to one of those high school renaming meetings or was outside with it, which I found amazing. And maybe we're just in the midst of a play it safe movement by the school board to make sure that any possible offensive name gets changed, because they too are caught up in the nationwide and local and southeastern move to get rid of these Confederate names, but maybe taking it a step further because they're concerned about maybe some colonial aspects of the Rebo name.
Yeah, you know, Fred, at the same time, let's talk about some more backstory at Lee High School, where a teacher who had championed the Black Lives Matter movement and is a fan favorite of the children there, she has been placed on leave because she displayed a Black Lives Matter flag at Lee. That is against school policy. We did get a letter from a teacher about this last week, and she writes, I am a teacher. I support Black Lives Matter. I stand with Mrs. D'Onofrio. That's the teacher at Lee. And this teacher writes the show and says, the superintendent cannot outwardly support Black Lives Matter when the district's data does not support it. Our BIPOC students, that's students of color, receive harsher punishments for behavior problems at schools and are consistently over-identified and mislabeled as having a disability. The schools that are being debated over represent some of the most neglected schools in the district in terms of meeting the diverse needs of the students. They've been neglected long before Dr. Green became superintendent. The conversation we need to be having is how to better these schools. We cannot move forward as a district until our students know that we see them and hear them. The only way to rectify our racist past is with an inclusive and empathetic approach to education. And she has a lot more to say in that email, but that, I think, gives you the thrust of it, Fred.
Well, it's fairly all-encompassing what she's saying there. The problem that that Ms. D'Onofrio has, of course, is that her actions were pretty much a clear violation of Duval County school rules, especially for posting signs and especially for instructors. While we've always had instructors who, you know, were on the right side of history, but they had to go through quite a lot in order to be proven right. Witness the Scopes trial, of course, from days gone by.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anybody publicly would necessarily criticize her, except for those who are not in favor of Black Lives Matter in particular. But you know, it was a clear violation of school board rules for doing what she did. And I understand it. And I think that she'll, you know, she won't get any, I don't envision her getting any heavy punishment for it. But moving beyond that, it's just a symptom of the problem. One of the other things that's interesting here is that a lot of the activity that's happening at Lee is being student-led. Witness the president of the, I think the senior class there, has been on the forefront of leading this effort of protest to get the name change and supporting Ms. D'Onofrio. Mm-hmm. And other students on a daily basis are out there talking about it. They're holding their own set of protests. And so it's not something that has gone unnoticed by the student population. And of course, this is something that the school board has to recognize because, again, we're having this pop up all over the county with other students who are leading protests of change in their area. And that's what we're teaching them. That's what we're asking them to do. Be aware, because civics is not a big class being taught in schools now. Mm-hmm. But it's just an important time. It's unfortunate that Ms. D'Onofrio will probably get some punishment for this, is being punished for it. But we do have to recognize that it was a violation because it had it been the opposite, someone putting up a pro-Trump flag with MAGA on it, we'd all be in an uproar by now.
Right. The district says it's trying to apply the policy equally. Okay, we're almost out of time, but I want to just touch on a couple of news and notes from the week. For years, it's been derisively called the Beirut Berkman, a downtown eyesore. It looks like the Berkman Plaza 2 tower across from the jail might finally be coming down. It's been sitting empty for about 13 years. This week, we learned a contract for a new construction company could be sealed in the next couple of days, and demolition could start in a few months. A mix of townhomes and retail buildings would go up in its place. That's the Berkman Plaza 2. You can't miss it if you drive down Bay Street. It's half built and has been for a long time. And one final note, the Jimmy Van Zandt Cancer Benefit happening tomorrow in Middleburg at Southern Social Whiskey Bar and Lounge. Van Zandt, a cousin to Lynyrd Skynyrd singer Ronnie Van Zandt, died in 2016 of liver cancer. This event will have Southern Rock, a car show, and more. I spoke about it with the late Jimmy Van Zandt's sister, Jane.
We're going to have a lot of bands playing, and it's in the name of Jimmy Van Zandt Cancer Charity. It's going to be a car show around 2 o'clock starting, and then I think the bands start around 5 o'clock.
So check that out. Have fun this weekend, whatever you do, but be safe, please. And I want to thank Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, Dan Scanlon, and Tim Gibbons for joining us this Friday. Always so great to get you guys' insights. Thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
Thanks, everyone. A quick break, and in a moment, he's an author and a fifth-generation Florida man. We'll speak with author Tyler Gillespie on his new book, The Thing About Florida, going beyond the caricatures of the state and examining its true complexity. That conversation's next. We'll be right back. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Europe finally makes up its mind.
The benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine overall outweigh the risks of side effects.
Plus a rift in Jordan's royal family and a muon mystery. Scientists say they found possible signs of a fifth fundamental force of nature. We'll explain it all on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, fifth-generation Florida man Tyler Gillespie says he grew up being embarrassed by his home state. But now Gillespie is embracing it inside the pages of a new book. It goes beyond the caricatures of the Sunshine State and examines its true complexity in often hilarious fashion. I spoke with Gillespie about his new book. It's called The Thing About Florida. Hey, Tyler. Good to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this book just had to be written. And of course, it had to be written by a Florida man. That's you. You are a fifth generation Florida man. Is that right?
Yes.
That's kind of unusual.
I think so. I mean, I think like maybe a third of our population is from Florida.
Yeah. So tell me about your roots in Florida. Let's begin there.
So my family lives on the west coast of Florida and the Tampa Bay area, and that's where my mom and my grandmother grew up, and then my great-grandmother was born a little bit more in North Florida, and she used to tell me stories about the outhouse and having, you know, her brother stick a pitchfork up the outhouse when she's trying to use it.
No, man. So from an early age then, you were clued into Florida's weirdness and goofiness. And I guess you were at a certain point, you were embarrassed to even be from here. But you'd get into that in the book. Yeah.
Right. So when I was younger, it just didn't seem that goofy. It just seemed kind of, you know, normal, what I was used to. But then when I moved out of state, that's when I started, people started to ask me about Florida's weirdness, and when I became a little bit more embarrassed about it, because they would ask me a bunch of questions about, like, why are so many weird things happening down there? And this was, like, when Florida Man was first becoming more popular. And so I was just kind of, like, I didn't really want my, you know, my Florida-ness to come out and be kind of associated with that.
So tell us then about some of the things about Florida that you examine in the book, because it's a complex place.
It is. There's so many, and that's the thing about being a writer in Florida, and I've come to just love how many stories we have in the state. So I started with the Florida Man headlines, because that's what kind of really first got me into these misconceptions. And then so each chapter in the book looks at maybe a different misconception. I look at, you know, pythons, because there was these headlines about pythons eating the state. And so I wanted to know more about that, and they're hunting the pythons. So who are the folks doing that? And then they're kind of connected, right? So then I'll talk about pet smuggling through that. And that kind of ties into issues of the environment and you know, different things like that. And I also talk about, you know, the Civil War reenactors and just the Civil War in general, because I was not really ever taught that Florida even participated in the Civil War. You know, growing up here, that's not something I was really super aware of. So I wanted to look more into that as well, because I think some people may act like Florida doesn't have this long, complicated history that it does, mm-hmm. and that we're just all about, you know, manatees and Florida Man or whatever, that it's just this kind of like...
Yeah, the thrust of your book is it's more, the state is more than the caricature of Florida that the rest of the country sort of sees. So in that sense, this book, I think, would be a great gift for anyone who loves this state despite all of its problems.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And that's the thing, like, a lot of people have a connection to Florida. Maybe their grandparents live here, or maybe they've gone to Disney World. So I think a lot of people, even if they're not born here or live here, have some kind of relationship to the state often.
So you also, let me point out, you are a gay man, but were raised Southern Baptist. So that is one way of you embodying the complexities of this state. And you write about that too.
Yes, that's a great way to put it. I hadn't even necessarily thought about it in those terms. I love that.
Uh-huh.
That kind of is a thread a little bit throughout the book. And in the last chapter, I talked the most about it. And that's something that kind of changed with the writing, is that a lot of the essays and the started as more reporting. And, you know, I wasn't in it as much. And then through readers and my editor encouraging me to add these kind of snippets of my life to connect the stories, that's kind of, then I became a little bit more comfortable with that. And then the final chapter is a little bit more personal, probably the most personal, talking about my life growing up in the church. And you know, we talk about that, and then also talk about the Joy MCC, which is an accepting church of, you know, all different kinds of folks. So just talking about how to situate my identity within a religion that meant a lot to me growing up and connects me to my family and to Florida, you know.
Mm-hmm. Even today. It's a great new book. Pick it up. The Thing About Florida, Exploring a Misunderstood State by author and fifth-generation Florida man, Tyler Gillespie. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Plus you. Keep the feedback coming. Emails always go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And check out our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. Also, make sure to tune in at noon for the Florida Roundup. That's our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories across the Sunshine State. And there's been lots of news this week in Florida. So join us then. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Friday, everyone, and a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.